Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
It's very fascinating, this notion of trust. We want it to be an output, but in fact, the only guarantee that it will be an output is that it should equally be an input.
Joanna Kolowski is a noted Australian and international mediator with wide experience in sensitive interracial and political settings in disputes that have included Indigenous groups, farmers, pastoralists, government representatives, environmentalists, industry bodies, and utility companies. She's held government posts in Australia, such as Director of Community Relations for Australia's Anti-Discrimination Board, and private posts, such as Chairman of LEADER, Australia's largest nonprofit dispute resolution organization. In this episode of IDN, Jo discusses techniques she has found effective when negotiating across cultures. In fact, we started with a story I heard told several years ago about a dispute involving an Indigenous group and a mediation that almost didn't happen due to a cultural faux pas that Jo inadvertently committed. I had this referred to me, by the way, third or fourth hand.
Yes. Well, this is the horse's mouth, or should I say the horse's tail, because on that occasion I think I had the tail in the mouth. I was picked up by my case manager. I was a member of the National Native Title Tribunal, and I had been assigned a particular claim. I won't go into how claims are made, by an Aboriginal community to some of its traditional country, as we call it in Australia. And I'd been picked up by my case manager. We then met with a group of Aboriginal people who happened to be in town and were going back to the place where the community was camped. And it was, in fact, on the site which was under claim. And when we arrived at this claimed place on a truck, and very often Aboriginal people get around the country in trucks, and we'd been sitting in the back of this flat-back truck.
Now, by the way, as I heard this story, you'd actually travelled quite a ways.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I used to go to work Moscow to Madrid. So 5 hours by plane to the destination and then 2 hours by car. So it was nothing to travel 7 hours before you even got to, and we're still in Australia. So here I am in northern Queensland. I arrive, and because I was the youngest person by far, with the exception of my claims of my assistant, I jumped off the truck as we approached a gate, and there's a protocol in Australia that if there's a gate closed, you leave it closed. So I opened it, the truck drove through. Then I closed the gate and hopped back up on the truck, both because I was close to the back of the truck and also because it seemed to me that I was younger by far than many of the people
on
the truck.
Very elderly women,
exactly. And when we arrived and we got ready to meet with the community more formally that evening, my case manager came to me, Louise came to me and said, "Look, Joanna, there's a bit of a problem. They think they don't want you as a mediator." And I said, "How could they possibly know? I've not been introduced to anyone really. I've just ridden in on the back of the truck. I've only just got here. What could be the problem?" And she said, "Well, look, I'll let such and such a person tell you." So I went into this group where the women were sitting around, and one of them said, and I said to one of them, "Look, I understand that I may have given offence." And That's an important thing to say to you, Mike, because I've already said that in Aboriginal settings you don't ask questions. You don't say, "Have I given offence?" You don't ask things which require a yes or no answer. It's regarded as deeply impolite because it pins people down, doesn't allow them to contextualise. So I said, "I understand that I may have given offence." And one of these women looked at me and said, "Yes, sister, you sure have. You're a guest here and you're behaving awfully like the host." And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're telling me." And she said, "You opened the gate on the only piece of land on the planet that we can call our own. And it was for us to welcome you to our land and not for you to welcome us. And I was incredibly distressed. I'm distressed telling you even today. And I went to something which is, in a sense, cross-cultural theory, but in practice it works, and the best theory does that. I went to intention and I said, when I did that, here's what I intended. I intended to show courtesy and respect, because where I come from, you open the gate for people rather than expect them to open the gate for you if they are perhaps not as able-bodied. And I also wished to show respect in that I didn't want you to touch a creaky old gate if I could. And they said, well, you intended respect, but we read disrespect. And what I learned then is that behavior alone does not get us across the line cross-culturally. What gets us across the line cross-culturally is intention. And there's a whole lot of literature I discovered later on what's called intentionality. But cross-culturally, the behaviors can be unshared and the meaning shared, or the behaviors shared but the meanings unshared. So in this instance, I used a behavior whose meaning was unshared. And it's often the case that people will fall into error quite unwittingly and have to be prepared for that as cross-cultural actors, if you like. You will get it wrong, and the way you get it right after you've got it wrong will often solidify the relationship, will demonstrate your ability to analyze your own behavior and to offer it by way of gift, if you like, as explanation of intention, but also to be prepared, regardless of that, to have given offense or to have got it wrong.
That's a powerful story. Now, what happened after you approached them and explained your intention was to pay respect, not to mean disrespect?
People literally came and hugged me. Literally hugged me. Literally put their arms around me.
It was a relief for them.
It was a relief for them because they've had too many dealings with people who come and arrogate to themselves the right to do things which properly belong to the Aboriginal communities, whose rights have long been overlooked, as you would well know.
You know, I've remembered that story since it was referred to me. As I said, it must have been third or fourth hand that I learned it. It was so long ago that I don't remember even who I heard it from, but it was told to me that that level of clarity and detail, it really sticks in people's minds. And what I learned from that story, where I actually learned two things. One is the terrible potential for miscommunication that can occur, but also the incredible power in cross-cultural contexts that people will make allowances for the other, that, you know, that they will recognize that you are different. And, you know, although you have done something that within their culture would be considered completely unacceptable because they know that you are different, they will let you get away with it. And I hadn't realized at the end of the story that they actually hugged you, that they were happy to overcome that misunderstanding.
I think the fulcrum of that turnabout is if you understand yourself enough at the level of intention to be able to talk about it. If you say, don't be silly, we always do that, and that's not what we mean, I don't think you get to the same point. I think you need to be able to say, you need to reflect on your own experience. Can I give you another example, which I used successfully, I think, in Hong Kong, which was that I said to people that in my own setting in Australia, being the daughter of immigrants, I try to say to people in powerful positions with whom I work, it's very important not to assert that this is a just society, rather to say that this society has been just for me, because that allows for the possibility that there is still work to be done, that there are social justice issues outstanding, and that the fact that the society has been just to me does not deny the society's, the fact that in another person's eyes, it is an unjust, society. And for that reason, I suppose when we come to talk about mediation, I say to mediators, with reference not just to the cross-cultural, but broadly to oneself versus the other, It's very important not to find yourself thinking, or if you find yourself thinking, this is silly, that's a silly option. It's very important to say to yourself, no, that option seems silly to me. Now I need to understand why it seems so self-evidently useful to them. And therefore, that's the question I'll ask. So you think that would be useful, do you? Tell me more about that. And that allows the other person to say, yes, I know that it seems silly, but I think they are really concerned about X, and it may be something you haven't thought of yourself. So to me, it's very important always to couch things in such a way that it allows for the existence of other views, and that makes space for those views. Now, that may not be always possible among the negotiating parties, because I believe that when parties negotiate, they shrink back into their narrowest selves. But I think for the mediator, it's incredibly important to keep that, if you like, that terrain wide.
If you tell the story that you told about the opening of the gate, had you said, just be silly, don't be silly.
That's not what I meant. Yes,
I didn't mean that.
Get real is the expression.
You had the courage to dig into yourself and say, wait a minute, let me figure out what it was that I was really intending and trust you enough to know that if I share that experience with you, you will respect that.
Yeah.
And there's some trust and there's some respect. And I suppose that's one of the things that probably makes great mediators great, is the willingness to have a unilateral expression of trust.
I find myself, it's fascinating that you should raise that point, because it's one that's never been raised with me, I think, in this sort of discussion before. And that is that I often say to parties, when they say, how can we do such and such, we don't trust them. And I say to them, if you think that trust is just an output, then we have to stay here for 10 years, because it will be a long time before you trust someone whom you're currently suing for breach of contract, for example. But you can make trust an input. There are things that you can entrust them with. It's for you to decide which those are, but your demonstrations of trust will call on a response which is trusting. And even at a minor level, some exchanges that are trusting will take place, and trust will be the outcome. You guarantee that trust is the outcome. After all, I said, you're not negotiating with your mother. And no disputes are more bitter than those in families where trust between people that have previously built their lives upon one another has been broken. So it's very fascinating, this notion of trust. We want it to be an output, but in fact, the only guarantee that it will be an output is that it should equally be an input. And people ask me as a mediator, what do you do if you think they're lying? And I say to people regularly, I never think people are lying. I assume that they're putting their best foot forward in commercial matters. Why not? One does that in court. Why wouldn't one do that in a mediation? And I always assume that people are telling me their version of the reality as they see it. Now, they may be deluding themselves that they didn't know or didn't receive or whatever the factual point is, but I do not operate as a mediator as if people are lying. I don't think I would get anywhere if that was my worldview. And if they are lying, and if the outcome is built on lies, it will self-destruct. And so I say to people in private session, only you know how genuine your offers are. If you make offers which tomorrow turn out to be not genuine, if they realise that you are the same party who did something else, the thing will self-destruct anyway. So the decision is yours. You play it as you like, as you see it. I will never know all the facts. I'm not your lawyer. I haven't got the trolley with all the documents. But you know what will make an arrangement here that will stick and that the parties will feel satisfied with.
It's funny. I have a line that I've used in negotiations when people get, even on my side or on the other side, get obsessed with what the truth is. And I mean no disrespect by saying this. It's simply that, I never know what the truth really is. I believe in the sincerity of the people within my company when we do have disputes and the cases that I get involved in, but I say, unfortunately, I don't traffic in truth. I traffic in perceptions of the truth.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. I think in most cases, people are, they may be self-deceived.
Yes.
I very often admit that's why disputes exist.
Sure.
Because one or both sides are self-deceived.
Yeah. And we carefully avoid remembering that one letter that makes a lie of everything we say. If I'm a party and I force myself to remember that you actually did write me a letter warning me not to do something and then I went ahead and did it, if I forget that letter, I feel much more justified in the position I'm putting forward now. And that forgetting, therapists tell us, is real, that there is a kind of disconnection, a kind of dissociation from some very unpalatable truths.
Well, I mean, actually, I would go even deeper a little bit than that and say that I think that's one of the things that helps us get up every morning.
Because if
we had to think of every negative implication and put everything on a real balance, we may be so discouraged.
Yes, that's right.
We may not want to go on each day. Yes.
So when people talk to me about the emotional in mediation, which I refuse, by the way, to call the irrational, because that's calling something by the name that it isn't. We know that emotion is not reason and that reason is not emotion. We don't call the rational the unemotional, but we do call the emotional the irrational. And it's, that occupation of negative space is a very interesting notion. But, when people talk to me about emotional elements of mediation, I'm fond of saying that they form part of the, of the makeup of that person, and to understand to see this person become distressed is to understand which issue has priority. For me, that's very useful in straight rational terms. If I said to them, is it issue 1, 2, 3, 4, or is it 3, 1, 4, 2, they'd probably say they're all on the same plane to me. But when they get terribly distressed about issue 4, I know that, in fact, it's probably issue 1. And for me, that's very helpful. I think the emotional is a very strong guide to that. So I don't want people not to... I'm happy for people to display emotion, even if it's anger or frustration, in a commercial matter, because it gives me a lead to where the nub of settlement might lie. If they've been deeply offended by the fact that the bank has changed their line of credit, much more so than they are about something else, then the restoration of a line of credit might be the very thing that oils the wheels.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.